I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. It's been a busy year so far in the nation's capital, with Congress passing a farm bill and debating immigration reform, all with the looming debt ceiling deadline on the horizon. To make sense of all these political events, I'll speak with 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Also take a look at local stories impacting Florida, like the governor's race, soccer stadium funding, and the fight for Orlando's District 5 seat. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, a former Democratic State House representative. He's also the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Welcome, Dick.
Great to be back.
And Lou Fry, of course, a former Republican congressman. He's the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Thanks for coming along, Lou.
Pleasure.
After years of bitter negotiations, Congress was able to come up with a $956 billion farm bill that President Obama signed last week. The main argument between Republicans and Democrats was that crop payments insurance and the trimming of $8 billion in the food stamp program. Lou Fry, what do you think the impact of this farm bill will be?
Well, I think there's enough misery in the sense of the farmers that's been spread that it probably politically isn't going to help anybody. Although, on the other hand, it's done with such a way, and I know the arguments that they're making, is that you got to do something now. We got to show some movement. Can't take it all. Look at all the money we have invested in this thing. So it was a dicey political one. And, you know, surprisingly, they handled it well.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, what are your thoughts? I mean, what does this decision show about bipartisanship in Washington?
Well, it shows they can make decisions on the heels of passing an appropriations bill. But there are some bad side effects, in my opinion. You've got about $10 billion cut out of the food stamp program, which is obviously going to hurt a number of people who are on food stamps, particularly those who are unemployed over 27 weeks. And then I should get to really look at the bill. I mean, it is crop subsidy, and it is farm subsidy. And depending on which side of the aisle you fall down on this, you can argue either way whether or not these farmers should be getting all the tax breaks they're getting to subsidize milk and crops and sugar and everything else. So there's certainly a debate to be had about that. But it does demonstrate politically that they can, like, reach a decision and actually pass something. Mm-hmm. Novel approach.
When you talk about food stamps, I guess they have a different name now, but what kind of impact are you going to see in Central Florida with that reduction in the amount of those subsidies there?
Yeah, the program is now called SNAPS, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and you're going to see some cuts in Florida. You can't cut $10 billion out of this federal budget and not have some impact in Florida. I don't know the real consequence of that, but if you couple that with the governor deciding he's not going to take the Medicaid expansion, you're going to have some people who are Medicaid eligible and food stamp eligible won't be getting Medicaid and with having their food stamps cut. So I can't tell you what that number is, but I tell you it will have an impact.
Mm-hmm. Lou Fry, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think the other agencies will have to pick up the slack there, the churches and the like?
Well, supposedly things are going to be paid for. So if you're putting a little more money in one agency, you should be taking that out of the other agency. And frankly, if they do that, it works.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're doing all right. But this bill has been politically dynamite since I got there in the late 60s. I mean, that was something you just sort of were glad when it was over. And the other thing, it was a great time for a little negotiating. For instance, the space program always needed some help and some more money. And
mm-hmm.
it was always a place if you could work with the people from the Midwest and their crop issues, which was somewhat easy in Florida. Because remember, most of our crops in Florida aren't subsidized. So we could be a lot more pure than people from other states.
That's true.
But it was a political football.
A place for negotiating. That seems to be not what's going on Capitol Hill these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually the last couple months they've done more negotiating than they have in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like it wouldn't be a political conversation without talking about the debt ceiling, another big issue, of course. The clock running out on the deadline to raise that spending limit. Estimates have the Treasury Department running out of spending by authority by February 27th, which isn't too far away. House Speaker Boehner has been talking with the White House, but no package has been proposed. Lou Fry, are we facing another bit of debt ceiling fight again at the end of this month?
Yeah, there's been 100 times the president has changed the debt ceiling in the Congress, you know, and they've written this legislation pretty well. It's going to be very simple to extend it if they can get the votes. The problem they've got is that nobody believes that the debt is really going to be bad, even though the numbers show that the percentage of the GDP could go up to 77%. And they also put out the fact that if they don't do anything at all, that all the money will be sucked up by the debt and by interest on the debt. And so the debt, we may swoosh by on this one, and I think we probably will. But sooner or later, someone's got to recognize we got that $5 million trillion gorilla out there who expects to be paid.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, what do you think the Congress needs to do to get the debt ceiling raised?
Well, one difference between now and the last time is you've got every Republican, including Congressman Boehner, the Speaker of the House, and Eric Cantor, the number two in the House, saying, look, we are not going to not pay our bills. We're not going to have that issue. We're going to solve this problem. Having said that, after Wednesday, they go into Democrats go into their annual retreat for leadership, and then the Congress takes the President's Day off for that week, and so they actually have one day after Wednesday, which they'll actually reconvene and be in session, which is the day before the debt limit is supposed to expire. So they've got a lot of work to do. So I don't think they have time for a fight or negotiations or
there's stuff the Treasury Department can do and different things that'll give them a day here and
right,
a day
sure.
there. And
they can move some money around.
Yes. And speaking of retreats, I mean, I read somewhere that after the Republicans had their retreat, that was when they formulated the idea that immigration wasn't going to move forward. And, of course, we heard about that this week. An immigration deal remains a long shot in a deeply divided Congress. Lou Frey, do you think this immigration reform is dead in the water this time around?
Never dead in the water. Always a chance with it, and maybe sooner or later they'll take what Dick and I have been saying about find some things in that bill that everybody likes and propose that bill, and maybe throw some stuff in about foreign taxes. I mean, you might be able to get a bill and put something that most people, even if they don't like, can hold their nose for. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not over till it's over.
Dick Batchelor, we've talked about this before, but President Obama must be looking at this and just gritting his teeth and thinking my legacy is under threat here. I mean, immigration reform is going to be one of those key sort of points right. in his legacy. So what would be going through his mind? What kind of strategy can he take going forward out of this?
I think he has mixed emotions on the short term. I think he sees the Republicans are really taking themselves captive again. They had a retreat, and then they retreated from their own position on immigration.
Yeah, but they went the right way.
Well, keep in mind, though, that there, you know, you had the 8 senators pass the bill, including Senator Rubio in the Senate, and it's a good omnibus bill. And then you have the House, several committees in the House led by the Republicans have passed some version, as Lou alluded to, some version of immigration reform, just not the path to citizenship. I think it still is a problem for them. I guess Republicans are betting that the Hispanic vote in all 4-year elections will not be that as predominant and important as they are in the presidential election. But I still think they've got themselves in a bind here. I thought Speaker Boehner pretty well had the Tea Party under control, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm. I guess midterm elections coming up in November, but as you say, Republican lawmakers thinking that it's not really going to help them with their voters, their particular constituency, if they make immigration reform a big deal.
Yeah, I think it will. I think in the congressional seats it won't because of gerrymandering. Everybody's got a safe seat. 95% of the Congress has a very safe seat, if not more. In the U.S. Senate races, I think they can make a big deal out of the immigration issue in a statewide election. So I still think it's going to be an issue, and the Democrats are going to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Lou Frey, you're a little more positive, though, about immigration reform and its chances.
Well, I'm positive because I think there's pressure on both parties to do something. And when you look at the issue of immigration, it isn't going to go away. It would be nice to get something. You could say, look, we did this, and this is the start of a 20-year plan or whatever it is, and build some momentum up because everybody's looking to 16. I don't think there's a big fuss about 14 yet because it looks like neither side is going to end up in control of both branches. I frankly think the Republicans are going to pick up 2 or 3 seats in the House and the 2 or 3 on the Democratic side in the Senate. I don't see the Republicans getting them, though it could be a couple of those races could be really close.
The one issue that Republicans keep raising, including Senator Rubio, is that, look, we want to secure our borders first. Well, right now we have hundreds of miles of fences and walls on the border. We have drones on the border. We have the National Guard on the border. This president's administration has spent more than the previous administration on securing the border. And so every effort has been made. So I think that's really kind of out for some of them to say, until you can prove to me with some efficacy that this has all been met, then we'll talk about immigration reform.
You're saying there's nothing more that can be done to secure that border?
I don't know why. There might be some marginal things that get to be done, but other than as much money as we're spending, and by the way, the president, by the way, has deported more people back to Mexico than any previous president has to try to enforce the laws that we have on the books.
Mm-hmm. And not just Mexico, I think.
Not just Mexico.
Hmm. Well, if we zero down now to state politics, recent polls from the University of Florida and Quinnipiac of Democrat Charlie Crist leading incumbent Republican Governor Rick Scott by about 8 points. The UF poll has 47% of voters saying they'd vote for Crist and only 40% voting for Scott. That margin has narrowed a little bit, though. Dick Batchelor, is this the kind of lead you expect Crist will carry through to the end of the year?
He will if he can keep the money going. As Lou and I point out, name recognition is the most important thing. Charlie Crist has name recognition, as does Governor Scott. And the people know both of these candidates fairly well, but there will be a launch campaign, a $100 million campaign on the other side, on the Republican side, to try to discredit Charlie Crist, saying that he's been all things to all people. And it's going to be a bitter campaign, but the advantage is Charlie Crist is now on a book tour. He's on the national talk shows, TV talk shows, so he's getting a lot of exposure. As long as you can get that and you don't have to pay for it, it's good. But the real question is, how much money can he raise? Does he peak out at $10 or $12 or $15 million?
Because that's not going to be enough?
No.
Oh, no.
Not at all.
Not at all.
The other thing that surprised me about that poll more than anything was the support that Charlie had from the Democrats. Mm-hmm. He had, I think it was 81% supported him. I think Dick and I had discounted the flip-flop, saying it probably wouldn't make much a difference. And we were right, but we were righter than we thought we were. I mean, that's a big item of supporting it. So where is this big bump that Charlie's going to run into? I still don't see it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's going to come down to writing the checks.
So I agree with that. And you haven't, as Lou pointed out, you got broad-based support for Charlie amongst the Democrats. But the real key is, where are your Democratic fundraisers? He has to give up his Republican fundraiser. The Mel Simmers of the world aren't going to write checks for Charlie Crist anymore. None of the Republican Party is going to write checks to him, but he's got to find Democratic people who are willing to raise money and believe in Charlie enough to raise money beyond John Morgan, who's doing a fabulous job, but he's going to need a lot of support, financial support. But if he peaks at $15 or $20 million, which is a good war chest, but facing an incumbent governor with $100 million in the war chest is not where you want to be.
It's going to be a question. The governor's got to look at the thing and say, let's see, I'm 4 or 5 points behind. My staff tells me we need 25 or 30 million to win this campaign. Is it really that important for me to spend 25 or 30 million dollars? Because he's got the ability to do it. And because nobody's really locked in, this is not a thing where you talk to people and they, if you say anything about their guy, they want to punch you. You know, it isn't sort of like that. It's like, oh, well, we got really don't have much of a choice. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the interesting part. If the governor may just say early on, well, the heck with this, I'm going to go ahead and put some money out and let it fall where it may. And I think that's what's going to happen. And that's probably his best chance to win. I think you got to, with what's going on and so forth and the economy and where everything is, I think it's a close race. I don't think it's a Democratic race by any means.
Well, Lufra, let me ask you this. Do you think there's any impact in Governor Scott selecting Carlos Lopez Cantera as lieutenant governor? Is that going to give him a bump at all?
I would think so. You know, you select a vice president for three things. One, to win the state. Two, not to say anything dumb. And three, to keep out of trouble. And Carlos is a fine candidate. He's got a legislative background. He is also someone who knows the business world. And he's also someone who has done well. And that, of course, is not going to be something that's a plus in certain parts of Florida or everything when you look at it. But it is a plus. And I think it was a smart appointment. And I think it'll be a plus for him in the race.
A lot of people turned down the offer of being lieutenant governor. Is this a good move for Mr. Lopez Cantera, do you think?
Well, obviously, anybody who's lieutenant governor wants to be governor. And you got to walk a line. You've got to do what the governor wants, and you have to be a hard hitter. You usually carry the bad news to the press with it. And, you know, who knows if the governor wins, then it's going to be the governor. Everybody's happy. If the governor loses, it's going to be everybody's at fault but the governor. So.
Yeah, the three people that are most...
That never changes, does it, Dick?
The three people most unhappy about the choice are the three people in the cabinet who want to be governor themselves, because what you have an incumbent lieutenant governor, if there's a re-election, he's 4 years, so he's really out front as a leading candidate. But I would say he made the right choice. I think Lou and I had said that it needed to be someone from South Florida, you know, Hispanic, Republican, former legislator. We missed everything except the female. We thought it should be a female, but I think it's a good choice. Keep in mind, there's a lot of pride associated with that, number one. And number two, the incoming Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court is also Cuban-American. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of pride attached to that. And keep in mind, the governor also appointed as clerk of the court here a Republican Hispanic himself. So
sure. Young Republican, chairman of the Young Republicans.
Right. So the answer is yes. I think he's making overtures to Hispanic vote, which is a very smart move. Now, does it cross over from the Cuban community to the Puerto Rican community? Puerto Rican community is traditionally Democrat by and far, but it could cross over some, making overtures to the Hispanic population.
Mm-hmm. Republicans are much more vulnerable in the Hispanic vote than they are in the women's vote.
Do you, Lou Frey, do you see that these appointments, and of course you mentioned that the Orange County
clerk of the court
there too. I mean, is this something of a sea change in the Republican Party? We're seeing like new, you know, the younger Hispanic, Cuban Americans, et cetera, coming through the ranks here, or is it just kind of savvy appointments from Rick Scott?
No, I think it is some savvy appointments from Rick Scott, and I think it's also Cuban Americans, the younger ones, are in the system. They're doing something. This young man who I had a chance to speak when he was chairman of the Young Republicans, very bright, very ambitious. And the generational thing, in essence, is there's nothing holding them back. They don't feel in any way inhibited about running as a Hispanic, and they shouldn't. I mean, that's some progress in our country.
Mm-hmm. Just one factoid here. The Hispanic Chamber in Central Florida is now the largest chamber of commerce, larger than the Orlando Area Chamber of Commerce, 1,450 members. You know, so it's very powerful. And then the I-4 corridor is usually the predictor for the statewide race, including the governor's race. And while there's a large Puerto Rican population, still having Hispanic overtures can't be undersold.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about the gubernatorial race and Charlie Crist, obviously the name John Morgan comes up. He's kind of acting as kingmaker at this point. But do you think he has some political aspirations of his own down the track?
John Morgan? I don't think so. I mean, I know John pretty well. I cannot imagine him wanting to run for office. He's got friends in high places and friends in low places, so I don't think he would ever run for office. But it's obviously getting Charlie Crist out there, if he could get Charlie elected, number one. He's obviously very close to Barack Obama. He's raised him a lot of money. Was at Michelle Obama's birthday party at the White House the other night, so he's got connections there. And look what he's done with $3 million by getting the medical marijuana issue on the ballot. So he can do a lot of things without ever having held office.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Frey. You can join the conversation online. You can send us a tweet. You can also follow us on Facebook, or you can send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Talking about Charlie Crist, again, we mentioned the so-called flip-flop going from Republican to Democrat. What about the fact that last week he announced his support to end the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba? This is a reverse from his stance when he was Florida governor and also when he was campaigning as an independent Senate candidate in 2010. Lou Frey, does this have some impact on his campaign, do you think?
Sure, a little bit. There's people out there who really like him now who didn't before, and there's people out there who really don't like him. And the Cuban-American community because of the success it has and the way it's growing and doing all sort of things, that isn't as much a single shot, Dick, as it used to be. And it's the families and the kids of the kids now with it, and they're cutting their own way a lot more.
Mm-hmm. If we look now at the minimum wage. President Obama renewing his call for wage equality in the State of the Union speech not too long ago, pushing for a national minimum wage of $10.10 an hour. And in another Quinnipiac poll, 47% of respondents in Florida favored that wage increase. Currently, we're at $7.93 now here in Florida. Dick Batchelor, do you think President Obama's push will be enough to reform minimum wage in Florida?
I don't know if it have any effect in Florida or not. The fact is, you know, to go from $7.50 to $10.10, obviously, over a two-year period of time is an adjustment that's needed. And there is an economic debate, and depending on where you land in this whole debate, whether or not if you raise the minimum wage, does it cause people to cut jobs? So do you have fewer jobs at paying higher minimum wage? And there's the other side of the economics profession that will argue it will not have any, but only marginal impact. So the fact is that people who are in that very low wage earning group needs to make more money. Keep in mind, we're not just talking about 17, 18-year-olds flipping burgers. We're talking about the average age of those people on minimum wage now is 35 years old. And some of them from two-income families. So it's not just somebody flipping hamburgers, supplemental income to the family. It's people, it's a primary wage earner.
Mm-hmm. Lou Fry, what kind of impact do you think it would have on Florida businesses?
My mom and dad had a printing thing on Orange Avenue, and my brother and sister worked there. And any change in the wage thing caused a lot of stomach growling and a whole bunch of other things because there isn't that much leverage. I mean, the Costco's and the Walmart's and all that, this is really... they're not the ones who get hurt by this thing one way or the other. I guess looking at it and the problems that Dick laid out, maybe the answer is yeah, let's do something instead of 2 years, let's make it three or something like that. But to help people help themselves, I have always felt that that's the best thing you can do philosophically. And so the government gets involved and does help. I voted, unfortunately or unfortunately, for the bailout in Detroit. The loan in Detroit, remember that?
Absolutely do remember that.
And it was all paid back.
Okay, let's talk about sports and politics. Orlando City Soccer receiving their MLS franchise, and now the team and the city are working on a soccer-only stadium in downtown Orlando. They do need a couple of pieces of land, in fact. One of them currently occupied by a church. Negotiations seem to have hit a bit of a brick wall there, and the city did vote to use eminent domain to purchase that property for the purpose of the stadium. Dick Batchelor, is this a good move or the right move for the city?
Well, I think the city needs to be very, very careful. While they have the ability for eminent domain under the state law and also the federal constitution, as long as you prove a public purpose, but when you're condemning a church, to me, it brings it to a higher degree of dignity. And maybe the compromise is you won't give the church what they're asking for, but you do a fair appraisal and double it or do something, because it's displacing a small business is one thing, displacing a church and a family of church, you know, a church family is another thing. So I think they have to be fairer than they have been to date. And while they might, again, have the right, that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the right thing to do. And if we're doing this soccer thing, we can't have it go down the tubes. This is really important and so forth. And I think what Dick said was right. Look at it and everything. And I think they made a fairly substantial order, if I offer. But anyway, start the process.
We're taking you off our prayer list.
Yep. Okay. I need it.
Well, turning now from sports to roading, former state representative Steve Precourt turned down an offer to run the Orlando-Orange County Expressway Authority. That offer, of course, surrounded by a bit of controversy because State Attorney Jeff Ashton was investigating an allegation that some of the board members may have met privately to discuss the offer, violating the state's sunshine laws. We haven't seen the end of that investigation yet, but you know, the Expressway Authority does control a pretty sizable amount of money, a lot of roads in Central Florida. What do you think this says, Lou Fry, about instability in the organization? Is this kind of a black eye for the Expressway Authority? What's happened?
Well, certainly not the kind of publicity you search for.
Sure.
That's true.
With it. And so, you know, that's bad, and that's an important agency, and it has a lot of money at stake. I don't know anything about it. I don't know people on the board or whatever, and I can only go by what I read or listen to, and it doesn't give you warm fuzzies.
It's particularly doesn't give Steve Precourt warm fuzzies. He thought he had the job at $185,000 a year, gave up his legislative seat for that job, but it was said from day one he didn't even meet the criteria that was advertised. Other people did, and it was political from day one. And there is this suggestion that some of the board members might have had some off-the-record conversations, which would violate the government sunshine law. Now Steve Precourt's been offered a month-to-month contract. He says he's going to refuse it, and he's been hurt by this whole thing. It's hard to prove damages if you don't have any damages. And he just looked like he got tied up in his own whirlwind and might have been clever by half in trying to get the job.
Some people say, well, it shows that things aren't quite right with the Express Rail Authority and they need to kind of clean house. What do you think needs to happen with this authority?
Well, first thing they need to do is fire a competent, qualified, experienced, seasoned executive director and then give that executive director some authority to make the changes necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And the board needs to obviously do their job. They've got a fiduciary responsibility. There are a tremendous amount of bonds issued, I don't know, $2 billion or something like that. So they've got a fiduciary responsibility, but they need to hire somebody who can really make those kind of internal changes if necessary.
There's some changes afoot in the city commissioner, Daisy Lynham, announcing that she's not running for that District 5 seat. Last week, of course, her son Juan Lynham filed for the same seat. And it seemed like there was a little bit of doubt as to what exactly was going to happen there. Could be Lynham versus Lynham, but Daisy Lynham stepping down saying she's going to support her son. What do you make of this whole thing, Dick Batchelor? It's kind of surprising little race within a race there.
A bit Machiavellian, a little clever. I mean, she has two opponents who filed against her, both of whom have criminal records and don't seem to be overly qualified for the job, to put it very, very lightly. And then she said she ran because no one was qualified to run, but for her son to step in, it's obviously had been talked about. I mean, we'd be very naive to suggest it hadn't been talked about. So it was obviously very intentional.
Finally, the Florida legislative session, of course, kicking off March 4th. Lou Fry, what are some of the big issues you're looking to, for some big results here?
I think one of the interesting issues is going to be the question of gambling.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be bouncing around under it. It's, you know, it's sort of nice to have a little money to throw around.
If you're gambling?
Yeah. Both. If you're gambling, the second part is you're gambling with our money.
Right. The legislature is going to have about $1.2 billion in unanticipated revenue from the Revenue Estimating Conference, so they've got money to spend. The governor wants to give away half of that, about $500 million in some kind of tax breaks. But it'll be interesting to see, because while they're putting more money into public education, they're still not where they were in 2007 on a per-student basis, so there'll be a demand to put in more money. Higher education, but you've got people like Senator Negron wants to do something about the waiting list for people with disabilities. So just because the governor wants it doesn't mean it's going to happen necessarily. And on the gaming issue, I think they're almost to the point to say they're tired of it. Let the next legislature have it and hand that hot potato off.
The other thing is that we know stuff is needed is out there. For instance, because we changed the law and kids now have to have civics, at least a year of it and so forth, that's great. The only problem is that we don't have any teachers who know civics. So we have been in the process of the Fry Institute of training teachers. And there's about 1 million kids that go through this program. And so when you look at programs or real needs in the state, if these kids don't get taught, they're going to fail the test. There's going to be a real bad problem if we let that happen. So, this is just one area I happen to know about personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're going to end up with some bills that aren't as major in some ways as other secondary bills that there may be a lot more time spent with, Dick.
Battle the Bucks.
I've been speaking to Lou Fry. He's a former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor and Reed. He is also the former founder of the Lou Fry Institute at the University of Central Florida. Thank you very much, Lou.
Pleasure.
Also speaking to Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thanks for coming in, Dick.
Thank you. Lou's still off my prayer list.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection, there you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.